The World Health Organization finally issues its report on how the coronavirus started.
This is just the very first step on a expectedly long trip to find the origin.
Plus, Russia is attempting vaccine diplomacy across the globe.
There's just not that much of it to go around. Russia has promised much more than it's been able to deliver.
Syria has now been at war for a decade, and the resistance movement is deeply divided.
These were people forced together who were trying to form an entity and who were not managing.
And in Greece, EU officials look to improve conditions in migrant camps.
To make sure that migrants have adequate living conditions and that local population have adequate living conditions.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. A much-anticipated report came out today. Its focus, how the coronavirus outbreak began. A joint international team of scientists that were part of a World Health Organization mission to China released their findings today. Scientists can't say for certain how the coronavirus outbreak began, but they did reach a preliminary possibility. The outbreak likely stemmed from an animal like a bat, then spread to other animals, then to humans. Marion Koopmans is a Dutch virologist who was part of the WHO's team of scientists that went to China to investigate the origins of this coronavirus. She joined us from the Netherlands. I asked her to tell us about the main conclusion of the new report.
So we found that the pandemic, so there was already substantial circulation of the virus in December. That was clear, a lot more than the cases that had been recorded. A second conclusion is that there's no evidence of such widespread circulation earlier than December.
And that's December 2019.
2019, exactly. And then we looked at the suspected market, the Huanan seafood market, and found that that has been involved. There has been an amplifying event, but it's possibly not the whole story. So that's an important one. From the market, there was traced back to many different places through different types of products, including wild animal meat, leading to farms in different parts of China that are worth looking into. And there was an exhaustive list of animals tested, more than 30,000 samples tested from a range of domestic and wild animals. That provided no lead whatsoever. So that's so far not provided a new inkling. So to wrap up, it's really a much deeper overview of the early cases, but not yet a smoking gun.
Your team looked at four scenarios: direct from something like a bat to humans, spread from a bat to an intermediary animal and then to humans, the virus coming from frozen food products, or a lab incident. Can you walk us through how you determined the most likely scenario?
So what we have done, so we made that diagram that was also shown in the press conference and that is in the report to help us aggregate the information. So there's a lot of data from studies finding, for instance, cases or testing of animals ruling out circulation. So there's information from interviews, there's information from literature. So we used that diagram to discuss where do we have bits and pieces of evidence and where not, and what is then the next step. So that's how we came to our stepwise discussion.
You were there in China, and the WHO Director General has stated that there was difficulty in getting access to raw data during the investigation. Why was that the case, and how did the team work around it?
So what happened is we went there with a team in full quarantine with online Zoom meetings, looking at a very long laundry list of studies that we had requested and for which data was being presented. So a lot of data was presented, shared, analyzed, reanalyzed at our request, and that's all described in the report. And there was initially with one or two of the team members, maybe the expectation that they themselves would have the data on their computers, and that proved to be challenging, in part for privacy reasons, but also in part because of this, the sheer size of the data sets and the fact that these studies have been ongoing well into the time of our visit and have been involving many different people from many different organizations. So it was a bit of a mismatch, I think, between the expectation and the reality of the work that was done.
MPG Koopmans is a Dutch virologist and member of the WHO's team investigating the origins of the coronavirus. She joined us from the Netherlands. Thanks so much, Dr. Koopmans.
You're welcome.
Zimbabwe's vaccination program began last month and started with health workers. Public health ads have flooded the media, but it's been a slow rollout. As of yesterday, only about 70,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccine had been administered in Zimbabwe. People are skeptical, including doctors and nurses, about a particular vaccine from China. Columbus Mavunga reports from the country's capital, Harare.
Zimbabwe's Vice President Constantino Chiwengam went on national television to get his second jab of the Sinopharm vaccine against COVID-19.
I'm feeling great. You can see I have been dispensing with my work. No problem at all.
Vice President Chiwenga doubles as the country's health minister and is worried about people's perceptions of the vaccine. 200,000 doses of Sinopharm were donated in February by the Chinese government. Chiwenga is talking about introducing a vaccine passport that people will be required to show at restaurants and stores. It's an effort to crank up low uptake among frontline workers, who include health workers and journalists. The country's main vaccination center is Wilkins Hospital. Three verandas have been turned into vaccination spots. Two officials at each of them wait to vaccinate citizens. No rest, Chakarisa is an SS aide.
I find it very important to get vaccinated so that we can fight against this virus together. As a health worker, I should not give this virus to patients, and I also protect myself from this virus from patients as well.
Freelance journalist Leopold Kudakwashe Munhende is there reporting on the program, but he plans to wait a few months to see the effects of the vaccine on others.
I have very little information about the vaccines themselves. I do not know the efficacy rate of any of the vaccines which government is importing. So at the end of the day, it's just a case of go and get vaccinated so that you don't die. More of a threat in a way.
This vaccination is free for every Zimbabwean.
As Munende is speaking to me, Shipo Shavarunzi is nodding in agreement. She is a nurse recently married. She doesn't want to speak on tape, but she says she has been told that the Sinopharm vaccine was not good for those who planned on giving birth. There is no evidence that that is true. Zimbabwe's government says Sinopharm has an efficacy rate of 76% against getting the disease at all and 86% against severe COVID-19. Other governments are waiting for emergency use authorization for Sinopharm vaccine from the WHO. Dr. Johannes Marisa, who represents health workers, explains why there are concerns about the Sinopharm vaccine among his colleagues.
Sinopharm was in clinical stage 3 of trials. Many people are worried that it has not yet completed the clinical trials. So a lot of people are very much worried about the safety of the Sinopharm vaccine, same with Sinovac.
Beyond healthcare workers and journalists, a popular religious leader in Zimbabwe has also declared he is never going to be vaccinated. Dr. Mnomen Matara is spokesman for the Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights. He is hopeful the government's passport idea will help the vaccine hesitancy. And he says it's important to dispute myths and misconceptions surrounding the vaccine.
We also need to rope in influential people to rally behind the vaccine so that more people can buy into wanting to get vaccinated.
With a donation of 75,000 doses of Covaxin coming from India, some which arrived in the country Monday, the uptake may change. The government has now opened vaccination to all who are willing. There's hope enough will show up to inoculate 60% of the country's population by year end. For the world, I'm Columbus Mavunga in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Today, Chinese authorities announced a sweeping overhaul of Hong Kong's electoral system. You might call the reforms a body blow for direct democracy. All candidates for seats in the city's legislative council must now be vetted by the National Security Bureau of Hong Kong's police. Essentially, Beijing and its hand-picked local leaders can now block pro-democracy candidates from the ballot. Here to help us understand what options remain for the pro-democracy movement is Hong Kong Democratic Party Chairman Lo Kin-hei. Lo Kin-hei, how significant are the changes announced today?
It is a very, very serious backstep that would hinder the participation of the pro-democracy camp or the opposition in the Legislative Council or in other forms of election in Hong Kong. It is very difficult for any pro-democracy camp figures to get the nomination and actually be running in the Legislative Council election in the future.
So will the group you lead, the Hong Kong Democratic Party, even bother to field candidates in any upcoming elections?
Frankly speaking, we don't think the legislature can do anything possibly to change the government's policy or to stop the unwelcoming legislations. That function is gone. You cannot monitor the government with the legislature in this kind of setting. But of course, we have to think of other means that may be still beneficial to the whole democracy movement. I think we have to think very clearly whether or not we will still like to participate in the election in the future. When we run for election, we want to run with dignity. We want to run without kowtowing, without bending our knees. But is it still possible? I think that is the question that we will have to ask in the next few months.
Do you think Chinese authorities would allow you to run for office?
I couldn't tell, frankly. If they want some oppositional voices to actually make them look better, to actually make the Legislative Council look better, maybe they will allow some of us to run.
Last month, authorities in Hong Kong arrested 47 pro-democracy activists, and these included some of the most high-profile individuals in the democracy movement, people like Joshua Wong, who we've interviewed frequently on this show. Has anything been heard from those activists lately?
All of those people who are in jail now, who are in detention now, are the leading figures of different oppositional parties in Hong Kong. People can still visit them. People can still talk to them. But the time is so limited. For example, I visited my party members, Lam Chua Ting, Andrew Wan, Wu Chi-wai, and each time I can only go in and talk to them in 15 minutes. And all those communications are recorded. So it is difficult to communicate very frankly and thoroughly with them. But yes, we can still talk to them in like 15 minutes a day.
Were you surprised by these changes that the Chinese government made?
If I tell you frankly, I would have never imagined that 2 years ago or 3 years ago. I would have said that that people is mad. That would never happen in Hong Kong. But now I think many of the Hong Kong people have already having the mental preparation that worse things are coming to Hong Kong. Although I still believe that we are not quite ready to face all these things so quickly.
The speed of the changes.
It's really, really quick. I mean, from the national security law to now, it is only 9 months and everything in Hong Kong is changed. That kind of pace and speed and the lack of scrutiny or balancing power is a very shocking pace for me.
Hong Kong Democratic Party Chairman Lo Kin-hei, he's been speaking to us from Hong Kong. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, the murder of Victoria Salazar in Mexico shines a spotlight on police violence. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's day two of the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with murder in the death of George Floyd. People around the world are following the case. In Mexico, there's growing outrage over another police killing. It happened over the weekend in the tourist city of Tulum. Authorities there have now charged four police officers in the death of an unarmed woman. The World's Jorge Valencia has more.
Mafia! The protests spread across Mexico's Caribbean coast. And in this chant, dozens of women say, "The police don't take care of me, my friends do." They were responding to the death on Saturday of Victoria Esperanza Salazar. Salazar was a 36-year-old woman from El Salvador who had been living in Mexico for the last 5 years. She had two teenage daughters and worked at a hotel in the resort town of Tulum. On Saturday, a passerby recorded a disturbing video of a police officer kneeling on Salazar's back. At one point, Salazar tries to lift her head while three other officers stand by with their hands in their pockets. The officers later picked up Salazar's handcuffed and limp body and dropped it on the bed of a police truck. An autopsy later revealed Salazar's neck had been broken.
Quisiera expresar mi pesar.
On Monday morning, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador surprised many by speaking out against Salazar's death.
Fue brutalmente tratada y asesinada.
She was brutally murdered, López Obrador said.
Es un hecho que nos llena de pena, de dolor y de vergüenza.
It's an incident that fills us with grief and shame, he added. He and the local authorities in the state of Quintana Roo, where Salazar was killed, vowed to bring the officers responsible to justice.
Híjole.
Mariana Bello is with an independent nonprofit called Gobernanza MX.
En defensa de los derechos humanos de las mujeres.
They lobby for women's rights in the state of Quintana Roo.
Aquí tú sabes que es el país en donde las responsabilidades se diluyen hacia los.
Mexico is a country where accountability gets passed down to the people at the bottom, Bello says.
Y los mandos superiores no asumen las responsabilidades que les toca.
And the people up top don't take any responsibility, she adds. In Mexico, an average of 11 women are killed every day.
Quintana Roo no escapa de la terrible ola feminicida que asola a todo
Bello says the state of Quintana Roo doesn't escape the wave of violence against women that has been washing over the country for years. She says the state, which is largely a tourist destination, has an especially high rate of trafficking of women and children. And she says governmental leaders have been saying for years that they don't have the resources to systemically address gender-based violence.
Pero pues no hay recursos porque el Estado no se ha reorganizado al interior.
But Joe says the state doesn't have those resources because it doesn't give enough priority to the issue. She says she sees a parallel here to the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis.
Para el Estado mexicano, la vida de las mujeres valen menos.
For the Mexican government, Bello says, women's lives don't matter. In the meantime, women's groups continue to protest in the state of Quintana Roo and across Mexico.
Lo que sí es innegable es que ya nadie puede no voltearnos a ver.
What's undeniable is that authorities can't keep looking away, Bello says. El Salvadorian President Nayib Bukele has also spoken up about the death of Victoria Esperanza Salazar. And Salazar's mother said she's traveling to Mexico to recover her daughter's body. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
If you look at the world's top vaccine producers, you'll find China, the U.S., and India heading the list. Russia doesn't crack the top five. This despite the fact that Russia is signing vaccine export deals with countries across Africa, Latin America, and Europe. Joining me now to talk about this is Judy Twigg. She's a global public health expert at Virginia Commonwealth University who specializes in Russia, Ukraine, and other parts of Eurasia. Judy, before we get to Russia's vaccine export program, how is Russia doing internally when it comes to vaccinating its citizens?
It's very interesting that you asked that question because Russia, of course, boasted of being the first country in the world to have its national regulator approve a vaccine back in August. They introduced Sputnik V with great fanfare. They've been very actively promoting Sputnik V through social media accounts and through press releases. And yet Russian domestically is falling quite far behind on vaccination. Right now, they vaccinated less than 5% of the Russian population.
What's behind the low numbers?
We suspected that it was production problems, and it was the case that Russia has had difficulty ramping up domestic production of the Sputnik V vaccine. In fact, Russia is now importing doses of Sputnik V manufactured in South Korea, and they look to import hundreds of millions of doses of Sputnik V made in India in order to cover their own population. So there's certainly a supply side problem in Russia, but there's also a demand side problem. There, for a large variety of reasons, is a lot of vaccine refusal and vaccine hesitancy inside Russia.
So what is Russia's strategy here? I mean, why is it making all these deals with other countries for Sputnik V while only a relatively small percentage of the Russian population is vaccinated?
This is an opportunity for Russia to emerge on the international stage as a major global health player, as a significant great power that engages in the kind of activities that great powers do. Great powers give assistance to the rest of the world in times of international crisis. Russia very much wants to be seen in that role. They were given an opportunity to do this because very early on there was this perception that the rich countries in the world were practicing a first, a very selfish orientation toward eventual vaccine distribution. That created something of a vacuum for countries like Russia, and we should mention China here as well, to step in and say, well, if the Western countries are going to keep all the vaccine for themselves, then we will magnanimously act to supply our relatively low-cost vaccine to the rest of the world. It was a great storyline. It took advantage of that opportunity, but now Russia is finding that it's not so easy for them to deliver on those promises.
Finally, Judy, notably last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin finally got vaccinated. Does the timing of his vaccination and the way it happened, which was not publicly, does that tell you anything?
It was a curious event. In terms of the timing of it, he received the vaccine quite a bit later than he was technically eligible for it in terms of his age. So it's curious that he waited so long. And since then, his spokesman has indicated quite candidly that they waited for Putin to take the vaccine because they didn't want to have that event ramp up demand for the vaccine in Russia that they weren't able to satisfy. In terms of his not being willing to do it on camera, Putin himself said publicly that he didn't want to do it on camera because he didn't want to, he used the word show off like a monkey. He didn't want to do some kind of aggressive public relations stunt. But that's odd because Putin has certainly never been camera shy before. And again, I think the explanation might be that they realize they don't have enough vaccine to meet any kind of significantly increased demand in Russia right now. And so they're trying to thread this needle pretty tightly. They want to be convincing that their vaccine is safe and effective, but they also don't want to ramp up domestic demand too much.
Judy Twigg is a global public health expert at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's been talking with us about Russia's Sputnik V vaccine production and rollout. Thanks a lot, Judy.
Thank you very much.
You're with the world. It's cherry blossom season in Japan.
We are always anticipating this kind of moment of cherry blossom. Always waiting. When is the full bloom? When is the full bloom?
But full bloom this year brings an ominous climate warning. It's the earliest peak since record keeping began 1,200 years ago. That story's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For the past 5 years, Greek islands off the coast of Turkey have been a first stop for refugees trying to make it to Europe. Hundreds of thousands of migrants from the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere have reached the shores of Lesbos, Samos, and other islands. Almost all of them wait out their asylum applications in camps, living in tents and difficult conditions. The Greek government and the European Union want to change that. This week, a top EU official is visiting Greece to announce plans for more permanent reception facilities on some islands. The World's Lydia Amanalidou reports from Lesbos, where the plan is facing resistance.
What's your name?
My name is Ahmad.
Ahmad has been on Lesbos for 2 years now. He says he fled Afghanistan in 2019 when the Taliban went after him for work he did for the government. He asked us only to use his first name for security reasons. Today, he, his wife, and three children are in a temporary refugee camp, along with 7,000 other migrants. The Greek government put them here in September after the camp they had been living in was destroyed by fire.
It's not normal. Yeah, we have lots of problems here.
The camp is crowded. Ahmad's family has to share one tent with another family, and it's right by the sea. So he says the winds made the winter very difficult. When it rains, their tent floods. There's little electricity, no school for the kids. And Ahmad says he and his family are only allowed to leave the camp for a couple hours once a week.
Well, right now we think that we're in jail.
Greek and European officials say conditions for migrants will improve when they build a new so-called reception facility on a different part of the island. But the plan has many opponents. This week, EU Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson visited Lesbos for announcements and meetings about this new site. As she landed by helicopter on Monday afternoon, a crowd of local residents gathered in the port city of Mytilene. They waved Greek flags and held banners that said, "No structures on the island. Europe must take responsibility." They chanted, "Greek islands will not be turned to prisons." Yannis Afiriou came to protest Johansson's visit and plans for the new migrant center. He says conditions at the camps on the island have been inhumane, and he doesn't believe that'll change when a new site is built. Nikos Karasavas is another local in the crowd. He says he's angry and fed up for different reasons. He told me enough is enough, that this island has done more than its share of handling migrants trying to reach Europe. Since 2015, more than 1 million refugees fleeing Syria's civil war and other conflicts have arrived on the Greek Aegean islands, many on Lesbos. At first, locals embraced them. Lesbos residents were even nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for helping refugees. But over the years, that warm welcome has turned to raging resentment. The island is now stigmatized, says Michalis Sikelis, a refrigerator mechanic whose family has lived here for generations. He chats with me as protesters march to the site where Johansson is set to speak. The number of migrants on the island has fallen significantly over the years, but Sikeli says the local community is still reeling, that the once thriving tourism industry has been depleted and that many have lost their livelihoods. Tensions have been especially high over the last year and a half. Local groups have attacked migrants and NGOs that work with them. As protesters march, they chant, "Lesbos belongs to Greeks." When they arrive outside the building where Johansson is set to speak, they gather around a man. He says the message is plain and simple. Locals will not accept a new migrant facility on the island. This will not be a dialogue, he says. It's the beginning of a war. Later, at the press conference inside a heavily guarded building, Johansson acknowledges local frustration, but she says a new permanent closed facility will be a step forward.
To make sure that migrants have adequate living conditions and that the local population have adequate living conditions. And I can.
She announced a €250 million, about $300 million, in EU funding for new camp facilities, not just on Lesbos, but surrounding islands too. Johansson gave few details about what the center on Lesbos will look like or when it will be completed. The Greek migration minister sitting beside her said the new site was chosen because of its remote location, far away from everything and everyone on the island. It's not just locals who oppose this plan. Migrant advocacy groups and NGOs say they're not convinced that a new site will guarantee better conditions for migrants. They want authorities to focus on processing asylum applications more quickly so that people aren't stuck waiting for a decision for years. Back at the temporary camp, I ask Ahmad what he thinks of being relocated yet again. His answer is not surprising. He says people here don't want another camp.
Yes, we want to leave this island.
He wants to relocate to another European country where he, his wife, and three children can start to build a better future. For the world, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou on Lesbos, Greece.
The word pandemic is largely defined as the worldwide spread of a new disease. Today, more than 20 heads of state and heads of global agencies said our current pandemic also requires a worldwide response.
Today, we are calling for an international treaty on pandemics.
Charles Michel is president of the European Council. He emphasized today that nobody is safe until everyone is safe.
No country, no continent can defeat a pandemic alone. It requires a global approach.
Lawrence Gostin directs the O'Neill Center for Global and International Health Law at Georgetown Law. He's also an advisor to the WHO. Lawrence Gostin, what exactly is a pandemic treaty?
Well, you know, it's a treaty like, you know, the Paris Agreement in the climate realm or a nuclear or chemical treaty. But this is going to be a treaty based upon pandemic preparedness, so that it requires countries around the world to conform to global norms, to have a strong health systems to respond and also to cooperate with the World Health Organization and other UN bodies in making sure that this never, ever happens again.
How big of a deal is it that so many European leaders are on board with this idea?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, the European Union and the UK have been really very active, you know, since the formation of the World Health Organization. They pride themselves on being global health leaders. They are a powerful group. And I should note also that Dr. Tedros, the head of the World Health Organization, also signed on to the joint letter. That's really very impressive. On the other hand, we have to notice who did not sign the joint letter, which is the United States, Russia, and China, three of the major powers in the world. So this is going to be really heavy lifting because no country wants to give up its own sovereignty. And that's what countries would have to do. They'd have to agree to a global compact.
Did the U.S., China, and Russia give specific reasons why they weren't signing on for this?
Absolutely not. No, they wouldn't want to go on public record about saying why they're not doing it. You know, my guess is that in the United States, which is of the three the most likely to join with our European partners, and President Biden is very pro-Europe, as we know, and pro-Europe alliance. But I think, you know, the United States has suffered so much itself with COVID-19 that it's kind of lost its moral global voice. We're very inward looking at the moment. The United States has been hoarding vaccines. And while, so you've got at least 30 countries around the world who don't have a single vaccine, and most of them won't get their populations vaccinated for years. We're going to have a glut soon, enough to cover twice our population. But I think we're just wounded and we're looking inside. We're not interested in global solutions just yet.
In your wildest imagination, what could be possible if a pandemic treaty like this were in place?
In my mind's imagination, it would be an enforceable treaty where countries had to have pandemic plans that they had to report openly and transparently of an outbreak, that they had to have enforced cooperation with the World Health Organization and the international community in investigating that outbreak. And also, you know, we're spending a lot of our time trying to respond to a pandemic. I would love to see us do something that prevents a pandemic. And we can do that by looking at how these leaps occur from animals to humans. More than 70% of all pandemic strains or emerging infections occur through these natural zoonotic leaps, which has occurred with SARS, COVID, MERS, Ebola. If we can prevent that through effective management of animals and human populations, that would be a blessing for mankind.
Lawrence Gostin is director of Georgetown Law's O'Neill Center for Global and International Health Law. He's also an advisor for the WHO. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
In the early days of Syria's uprising 10 years ago, one line in a popular revolutionary song went like this: "Freedom, freedom, we want freedom. It's not up to you, Bashar. We want our freedom." A decade later, Bashar al-Assad is still the president of Syria, and there is still no freedom. As for the Syrian opposition that rose up against the Assad government, it's in disarray. The World's Omar Dowagi reports.
In March of 2011, Syrians stopped being afraid. They lost their fear of the dictatorship that had ruled Syria for decades. In cities across the country, they took to the streets by the thousands with one goal in mind: to topple the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Syria's opposition came to life like never before. And at the height of the uprising, it seemed inevitable that the revolution was going to succeed. Assad's days in power were numbered. The opposition was just too big and too motivated to fail. But something else became clear very quickly. There wasn't one united opposition to Assad's government. There were many. And oftentimes, these groups had very different visions for the future of Syria.
It is not a united opposition, that goes without saying.
Reem Alaf is a Syrian writer and political analyst based in Vienna. She says uniting the different political opposition groups was next to impossible because of opposing interests and foreign involvement.
It was very difficult to put all these people together. Nevertheless, they tried. For the Syrian people, they could only see gradually that these were people forced together who were trying to form an entity and who were not managing.
As the political opposition squabbled, Syria's uprising was descending into a military conflict. The armed opposition became far more influential for one simple reason.
They were inside Syria and the political opposition was not.
Charles Lister is an expert on Syria's opposition groups with the Middle East Institute in Washington. He says political opposition groups were detached from what was happening on the ground in Syria. As the fighting intensified, a wide array of armed groups got support from outside the country.
To sustain a meaningful insurgency, to not be swiftly mopped up by the regime, required money, required weapons, required ammunition.
But with money, Lister says, also came ideological influence.
This kind of Islamist rhetoric and imagery or symbology began to spread across the identities of so many of these groups. They were trying to acquire the attention of Islamist-minded funders and governments, mostly based in the Gulf, some based in Turkey.
This created more divisions among the opposition between the Islamists and the secular opposition groups, some of whom got support from the U.S. But by 2015, the tide in the civil war started to turn against the opposition. Charles Lister says that's thanks to Russian and Iranian support for the Assad government, and specifically air support, something the opposition never got from its allies.
They came up against, at first, one air force, the Syrian air force, and then ultimately two. And if you don't have any form of air cover, you simply cannot sustainably take and control ground.
It took several years, with hundreds of thousands of Syrians killed and millions displaced. But Syrian government forces reimposed their control over most of the country. And today, Lister says, Syria's military opposition is a shadow of what it once was.
The armed opposition has largely been in the north, taken over by Turkey and exploited and used for in pursuit of Turkey's national security interests.
Meanwhile, Syria's political opposition is trying to exert some influence. Qutayba Idilbi is the U.S. representative of the Syrian Opposition Coalition. He says they're working to improve the living conditions of Syrians inside the country.
And we need to focus on those people and give them something in return, to at least give them a promise of a future for their children.
Earlier this month, Syrians in opposition-held areas once again took to the streets in protest. They marked 10 years since the uprising began. But after such a long and costly struggle, Syria's different opposition groups seem further than ever from their goal of toppling the Assad regime. Here's Reem Alaf again.
Today, at the 10th anniversary of the Syrian revolution, it is no secret that the vast majority of Syrians are disillusioned with their opposition and with their prospects, given the way the international community has really abandoned them.
With Syria's economy in freefall, many ordinary Syrians are having a hard time just making ends meet. Instead of freedom, dignity, or democracy, they're hoping for some stability and some bread on the table. For the world, I'm Omar Dowagi.
It's been a tough school year for students and teachers pretty much everywhere, but some elementary students up in Winnipeg, the capital of Manitoba in Canada, used their time to take on quite a project. They tackled a popular children's song that had been translated into Cree decades ago. That's an indigenous language spoken in parts of Canada and northern Montana. Cree language instructor Colleen Omond taught the children the Cree version.
It took quite a long time to get used to the word because, as you know, our Cree words are really long.
That was in January.
So we practiced daily, repeated the words slowly.
Then, wearing masks and social distancing, they made a video. Nailed it in two takes. The children sung their version of the Canadian children's song Baby Beluga in Cree.
I never expected that my students would win first place, and I'm like so proud and excited for them.
The video was an official entry from Winnipeg's Isaac Brock School in a contest sponsored by the Manitoba Aboriginal Languages Strategy. The school won $500 and high marks from people across Manitoba. Again, teacher Colleen Omond.
But the comment that really touched my heart is when the elders are watching the video and they're very impressed and happy.
As for the Canadian songwriter who wrote Baby Beluga, here's Rafi's reaction.
Oh, this is such a good story. It made my heart smile and sing to hear the children's voices. I'm thrilled that Baby Beluga can inspire reclaiming language. I think it's wonderful.
Special thanks to CBC Radio 89.3 in Winnipeg for that audio. You can see the students' video singing Baby Beluga in Cree, along with some of the kids' original drawings on Twitter, at The World. Iran and the U.S. can't seem to find any common ground. But that hasn't stopped Iran from making deals elsewhere. Iran and China signed a massive economic and security pact over the weekend. Beijing gets discounted Iranian oil, and Tehran is slated to get billions of dollars in Chinese investment. With us now to discuss this further is Isfandiar Batmanghelidj. He focuses on Iranian economic diplomacy and development and is a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. Isfandiar, can you start off by telling us what prompted Iran to look in China's direction in the first place?
Iran is looking to China for the same reason that most developing economies around the world have been looking to China over the last 10 years. China emerged onto the world scene as a major supplier of industrial goods around 2008. And then in 2013, when it launched the Belt and Road Initiative, it began to position itself as really the leading global investor in energy and transportation infrastructure. And for a country like Iran that's at a critical stage in its development, China became a sought-after economic partner. But the fact that Iran is looking towards China, therefore, is not simply a function of the fact that they have had this difficult position under U.S. sanctions. It's something that is actually quite common to countries that are trying to take that next leap in their development.
But are the impact of Western sanctions playing any role in Iran's interest in dealing with China?
I think that Iran has signed this deal in part, and particularly right now at a moment when there is this kind of impasse with the Biden administration, to send a signal that it's not going to be vulnerable to U.S. economic pressure forever, and that Iran has other partners and other means of trying to push forward on its economic development. But as I mentioned, you know, the reality of the China-Iran trade relationship and investment relationship has been one in that sanctions imposed by the U.S. have had a strong impact on actually keeping the extent of that relationship far lower than it probably should be. So if you compare Iran to other countries that have signed the same kind of deal that Tehran has just signed with Beijing this past weekend, countries like Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, all of those countries have benefited from more Chinese foreign direct investment than Iran has, despite the fact that Iran is arguably a better fit as a partner for China, given its strategic location and the size of its economy. And so you can sort of deduce from that actually the U.S. continuing to sort of raise barriers to this economic relationship is something that both China and Iran will probably want to have come to an end. And, you know, in that context, it's worth remembering that China is a party to the Iran nuclear agreement and would like to see the U.S. re-enter that agreement and therefore give Iran the benefit of sanctions relief that would then allow this deal that they have just signed to sort of flourish in the way that is probably intended.
How have Iranians reacted to this deal?
Well, the lack of transparency about the terms of the deal, and I think a lot of the international reporting about the deal, has led to a lot of concern on the part of Iranians that they're going to become overly dependent on China economically. But I think a lot of that concern stems from an overestimation of China's economic position in Iran and an assumption that Iran's government is about to, you know, sell the interests of the country down the river in order to send a signal to the U.S. The Iranian government has tried to sort of push back on some of those fears by pointing out that this agreement is simply a roadmap, that there are actually no clear commitments around figures, for example, for investment or targets in the agreement, and that it's basically a framework for a kind of relationship between the two countries.
Esfandiar Batmanghilij focuses on Iranian economic diplomacy and development. He's a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
Cherry blossom season is underway in Japan. People walk, picnic, and stage photo shoots beneath the blossoms during the fleeting weeks they're in bloom. This year, Kyoto's flowers reached their peak bloom on Friday, the earliest date since records began in the 9th century. The World's Carolyn Beeler reports on how a nation's fascination with the bloom provides a window into our changing climate.
Cherry blossom season starts with the first smell of spring, at least according to Nozomi Uematsu.
We are always anticipating this kind of moment of cherry blossom.
She remembers as a kid growing up outside of Tokyo, watching the first buds start to emerge.
Always waiting. When is the full bloom? When is the full bloom?
Japanese newspapers print official forecasts. YouTubers explain how to plan the best picnic under the white and pink branches.
Hey guys, today we are in Ueno, and we are going to show you how to have the best hanami experience in Japan. Let's go!
This fascination dates back centuries. Uematsu is now a Japanese studies lecturer at the UK's University of Sheffield and says mentions of watching cherry blossoms in Japanese poetry date back to the 8th century.
Around that time, really, aristocrats really started planting the cherry blossom and then having a party, including reading poetry.
Diaries and chronicles written by emperors, aristocrats, governors, and monks in Kyoto provide a surprisingly complete look at when cherry blossoms have flowered over the past 1,200 years. Yasuyuki Aono, a scientist at Osaka Prefecture University, has tracked the dates that blossoms hit their peak bloom back to the year 812 using those written records. Since about 1800, the data suggest full flowering dates have gradually been moving earlier. And this year, the blooms in Kyoto hit their official peak on March 26, earlier than ever recorded. Tracking when and how plants and animals change with the seasons is called phenology. Teresa Crimmins is the director of the USA National Phenology Network.
So phenology is this funky, old-fashioned word for a phenomenon that we are all really quite familiar with.
Written records of everything from grape harvests in Europe to the arrival of migratory birds in North America help scientists piece together the phenological record. As global temperatures rise, many spring things are happening earlier and fall things are happening later. But these changes aren't happening in sync. A classic example, a flower might bloom earlier in a warmer year, but the bee that pollinates it might be on the same old schedule.
And when that occurs, when we have years where things don't line up, there's losers all around. The plants that depend on the pollination service don't necessarily get it. And the pollinators that are depending on those flowers as a food source can suffer as well.
For most species, scientists don't have the long phenological record they do for Kyoto's cherry blossoms. So they're just starting to get a sense of how relationships are changing between paired species, like plants and their pollinators, or migratory birds and what they eat during stopovers. Who knows, maybe evidence from today's YouTube videos will help scientists tackling those kinds of questions 1,200 years from now. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow. From PR.